Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Hutchings, dialing in from beautiful Southeast Idaho. It is Think and Grow Rich Thursday, September 6, 2012. It is a great day to be alive, folks. I'm excited to be here. You know what I did this morning? I went in the gym and I ran 3.5 miles. I put on my headset. I had amazing, epic music pumping through my ears. And as I got going, as the blood got going and my lungs are pumping the oxygen in and out, I just wanted to scream about life. And I just felt this life force pulsing throughout my veins. And I realized that life is amazing. Life is a miracle. And folks, if you ever want to feel good about life, sometimes you get down a little bit. Sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're a little bit tired and not real excited about moving forward. Get in the gym. Get out on the road. Run. Just run. Get some good music pumping through your veins. Get the oxygen moving. Get in touch with that life force that you have within your body. I'm telling you, it's powerful. It is powerful, and you'll be excited about life if you do that. You may want to, if you haven't done that today after this call, you may want to do that right after we get off this call. One of the things I want to share with you before we jump into the content is every once in a while in life, every once in a while, someone seems to take your brain, put it in a slingshot, and shoot it up over the clouds. Have you ever had that feeling where every once in a while you get a piece of information? Maybe it's in a book. Maybe it's in a song. Maybe it's from something someone says. Like yesterday, someone said something on the call that did that for me. Someone said, great people talk about ideas. Average people talk about events. And small people talk about people. That was an idea that I'd never heard. And it was like someone took my brain, put it in a slingshot, and shot it up over the cloud and allowed me to see a little bit further. Folks, that's what we're going to do today. I'm going to share with you some information that has done that for me, has done that for many people, and I'm excited about the new perception, the new awareness that I'm going to gain from this call and that hopefully you will gain as well. Thank you for being here. I've got to tell you one more thing before we jump into the content of the call. You know, sometimes in the home business industry, which I'm in, and many of you on the call are in the home business industry, you ever get the feeling that sometimes you want it more for people than they want it for themselves? You ever get that feeling that sometimes you want your freedom and you want their freedom so bad, and sometimes it seems like you talk to person after person after person and they just don't care? I mean, they say they do, they kind of want it, but they don't really have that burning desire for freedom. You ever get that feeling? Well, I was feeling like that a little bit yesterday and this morning, and you know what I thought of? I thought of this call, and I thought of the 80 to 100 entrepreneurs we have right now on a daily basis that pick up the phone and dial into this call. And I realized that there are so many people out there. Thanks to you giving me this reminder, there are so many people out there that want freedom bad, that are willing to fight for it, that are willing to do the things that will be a little bit uncomfortable, that are willing to put themselves in a position where other people might make fun of them and put them down and criticize them. There are people out there like that. You are living proof. I am living proof. Every person on this call is living proof. So let us not get down by the seeming numbers that maybe seem to want it less as bad as we do. Folks, we're sorting and sifting, and we need to find those people like you. We need to find those people like me, because they're out there. Just a few years ago, I was working in a job that I did not like for a wage that I did not care much about. I was grateful for it, but it really wasn't giving me the life that I wanted to live. I had my children at home, my wife at home, and this company was flying me all over the country. And I was one of those people that needed to be found. I was one of those people that needed to have the message shared with me. I was one of those people that needed to have my brain put in a slingshot and shot over the cloud so that I could see clearly what was possible for me and my family and life. So folks, those people are out there. You and I are living proof. Let us keep up the search, and let us right now jump into the content of the call today, which I'm so excited about. We're going to cover the first part of chapter 2 in the book Think and Grow Rich, and we're going to jump right into it. This is called Desire, the Starting Point of All Achievement. The first step toward riches. When Edwin C. Barnes climbed down from the freight train in Orange, New Jersey more than 30 years ago, he may have resembled a tramp, but his thoughts were those of a king. As he made his way from the railroad tracks to Thomas A. Edison's office, his mind was at work. He saw himself standing in Edison's presence. He heard himself asking Mr. Edison for an opportunity to carry out the one consuming obsession of his life, a burning desire to become the business associate of the great inventor. Barnes' desire was not a hope, it was not a wish, it was a keen, pulsating desire, which transcended everything else. It was definite. The desire was not new when he approached Edison. It had been Barnes' dominating desire for a long time. In the beginning, when the desire first appeared in his mind, it may have been, probably was, only a wish. It was no mere wish when he appeared before Edison with it. A few years later, Edwin C. Barnes again stood before Edison in the same office where he first met the inventor. This time, his desire had been translated into reality. He was in business with Edison. The dominating dream of his life had become a reality. Today, people who know Barnes envy him because of the break life yielded him. They see him in the days of his triumph without taking the trouble to investigate the cause of his success. Barnes succeeded because he chose a definite goal, placed all his energy, all his willpower, all his effort, everything back of that goal. He did not become the partner of Edison the day he arrived. He was content to start in the most menial work as long as it provided an opportunity to take even one step toward his cherished goal. 5 years passed before the chance he had been seeking made its appearance. During all those years, not one ray of hope, not one promise of attainment of his desire had been held out to him. To everyone except himself, he appeared only another cog in the Edison business wheel. But in his own mind, he was the partner of Edison every minute of the time from the very day that he first went to work there. It is a remarkable illustration of the power of a definite desire. Barnes won his goal because he wanted to be a business associate of Mr. Edison more than he wanted anything else. He created a plan by which to attain that purpose, but he burned all bridges behind him. He stood by his desire until it became the dominating obsession of his life and finally a fact. When he went to Orange, he did not say to himself, "I will try to induce Edison to give me a job of some sort." He said, "I will see Edison and put him on notice that I have come to go into business with him." He did not say, "I will work there for a few months, and if I get no encouragement, I'll quit and get a job somewhere else." He did say, "I will start anywhere. I will do anything Edison tells me to do, but before I am through, I will be his associate." He did not say, "I'm going to keep my eyes open for another opportunity in case I fail to get what I want in the Edison organization." He said, "There is but one thing in this world that I am determined to have, and that is a business association with Thomas A. Edison. I will burn all bridges behind me and stake my entire future on my ability to get what I want." He left himself no possible way of retreat. He had to win or perish. That is all there is to the Barnes story of success. A long while ago, a great warrior faced a situation which made it necessary for him to make a decision which ensured his success on the battlefield. He was about to send his armies against a powerful foe whose men outnumbered his own. He loaded his soldiers into boats, sailed to the enemy's country, unloaded soldiers and equipment, then gave the order to burn the ships that had carried them. Addressing his men before the first battle, he said, "You see the boats going up in smoke? That means we cannot leave these shores alive unless we win. We now have no choice. We win or we perish." They won. Every person who wins in any undertaking must be willing to burn his ships and cut all sources of retreat. Only by doing so can one be sure of maintaining that state of mind known as a burning desire to win, essential to success. The morning after the Great Chicago Fire, a group of merchants stood on State Street looking at the smoking remains of what had been their stores. They went into a conference to decide if they would try to rebuild or leave Chicago and start over in a more promising section of the country. They reached a decision, all except one, to leave Chicago. The merchant who decided to stay and rebuild pointed a finger at the remains of his store and said, "Gentlemen, on that very spot, I will build the world's greatest store, no matter how many times it may burn down." That was more than 50 years ago. The store was built. It stands there today, a towering monument to the power of that state of mind known as a burning desire. The easy thing for Marshall Field to have done would have been exactly what his fellow merchants did. When the going was hard and the future looked dismal, they pulled up and went where the going seemed easier. Mark well this difference between Marshall Field and the other merchants, because it is the same difference which distinguishes Edwin C. Barnes from thousands of other young men who have worked in the Edison organization. It is the same difference which distinguishes practically all who succeed from those who fail. Every human being who reaches the age of understanding of the purpose of money wishes for it. Wishing will not bring riches, but desiring riches with a state of mind that becomes an obsession, then planning definite ways and means to acquire riches, and backing those plans with persistence which does not recognize failure, will bring riches. The method by which desire for riches can be transmuted into its financial equivalent consists of six definite practical steps. First, fix in your mind the exact amount of money you desire. It is not sufficient merely to say, I want plenty of money. First, be definite as to the amount. There is a psychological reason for definiteness which will be described in a subsequent chapter. Second, determine exactly what you intend to give in return for the money you desire. There is no such reality as something for nothing. Third, establish a definite date when you intend to possess the money you desire. Fourth, create a definite plan for carrying out your desire and begin at once, whether you are ready or not, to put this plan into action. Fifth, write out a clear, concise statement of the amount of money you intend to acquire. Name the time limit for its acquisition, state what you intend to give in return for the money, and describe clearly the plan through which you intend to accumulate it. Sixth, read your written statement aloud twice daily, once just before retiring at night and once after arising in the morning. As you read, see and feel and believe yourself already in possession of the money. It is important that you follow the instructions described in these six steps. It is especially important that you observe and follow the instructions in the sixth paragraph. You may complain that it is impossible for you to see yourself in possession of money before you actually have it. Here is where a burning desire will come to your aid. If you truly desire money so keenly that your desire is an obsession, you will have no difficulty in convincing yourself that you will acquire it. The object is to want money and to become so determined to have it that you convince yourself that you will have it. Only those who become money conscious ever accumulate great riches. Money consciousness means that the mind has become so thoroughly saturated with the desire for money that one can see oneself already in possession with it. And I'm going to stop the read of Think and Grow Rich right there, and I'm going to make a comment. And then I'm going to share with you a piece of content that did what I talked about earlier for me. Took my brain, put it in a slingshot, and shot it up over the clouds so that I could see a little bit clearer. And what I'm hoping by sharing this next piece of content with you will do is help you to see a little bit clearer, okay? The comment I want to make on the content we've just gone through is there are some statements in here which you might be having some inner struggle with. And the reason I know this is because I've gone through the same inner struggle. And I'm going to repeat some of these statements here. If you truly desire money so keenly that your desire is an obsession, you will have no difficulty in convincing yourself that you acquire it. The object is to want money and to become so determined to have it that you convince yourself that you will have it. Okay? Does that give you some inner struggle? And the reason why I ask that is because just a natural thought or statement that you should desire money, and even Napoleon Hill says you should be obsessed by the desire for money. Any of us who have ever had any sort of a background in faith, in religion, in even just traditional wisdom of the society that we grow up in, here in America, if you're here in America, and I'm not quite, I can't speak for other countries, but we kind of grow up with this feeling that money is evil. And there are some lines that are oft repeated. Money is the root of all evil. And then even those who understand or maybe are a little bit more adept at their study of the Bible will correct you and say, no, money is not the root of all evil. What the Bible says is the love of money is the root of all evil. Well, Napoleon Hill's telling us we should have an obsession for money. So isn't that loving money? Isn't that evil? Isn't that wrong to do? And folks, if we have these inner struggles right now, it's okay. It's natural because I think most of us go through this stuff. But we have to face it, and we have to, instead of just skipping mulling over it. We've got to face it, and we've got to think about it, because this is the first step. Be definite to the amount of money you want. Develop a white-hot burning desire for that amount of money, and Napoleon Hill even says to the point of obsession. What I want to read with you right now is a little piece of content from an epic novel. Epic. If you've ever run into something that is so out of the ordinary, if you've ever run into somebody who has a talent in their field that is just extraordinary, epic is a good word to use to describe what that talent is or what that ability is or what that person has done. And there's a novel called Atlas Shrugged that I believe is an epic novel. I'm reading this novel, and although I can't say I agree with all of the philosophy that's presented in this novel, this author is absolutely epic in her ability to weave her philosophy throughout the characters in the book, throughout the speeches in the book, throughout the dialogue in the book. And when you read this book, even though you might not agree with all of her philosophy, you've just got to sit back with respect and say, my goodness, this lady has done something with this book. She has used her talent. She has, I mean, it's almost like this stuff comes from another world. It's so good. Her ability to use language to describe things, to describe life, and to weave her philosophy throughout the story, it's epic. And as I'm reading this book, I get to page, I don't know, it's about 400. This is an 800-page novel. And I get to about midway through this book, and there's a speech given by a character in the novel named Francisco de Anconia. And this speech that he gives is about money. And I want to read this speech to you because it might give you another view or another viewpoint as to the virtues of money. Isn't that interesting that I would use the word virtue in the same sentence as money? Well, if that seems strange to you, I want to read this speech to you and invite you to open your mind and just think about some of the things that Francisco is stating in this speech. And I'm not asking you to accept everything. I'm not asking you to take it all and say it's all true. I'm just asking you to open your mind and think about this this view of money that you may never have been exposed to before, because I certainly wasn't. And as I read this speech, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the total opposite view of money that I've been raised with and that I've seen talked about in the circles that I've grown up in, so on and so forth. Okay, so let's get through this, and then we're going to open up the line for discussion. And I am so excited to hear this discussion because this might raise a little bit of controversy, but you know what? It's going to be so much fun to talk about, okay? So I'll set this up a little bit. Francisco is at a wedding party, and in this wedding party, there are a lot of people, socialites. This actually takes place in New York City, and there are people at this party who are talking about how money is the root of all evil. And Francisco happens to overhear these lines. And Francisco comes from a wealthy family in Mexico. He's an heir to a great fortune. And he was raised with sophistication and education, and he has a value for entrepreneurship, and he has a value for the mind. And so if you can imagine Francisco sitting at this party in New York City, overhearing a few people talking about how money is the root of all evil. And here's what Francisco says. He says, "So you think that money is the root of all evil," said Francisco de Anconia. "Have you ever asked what is the root of money? Money is a tool of exchange which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle that men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers who claim your product by tears or of the looters who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by men who produce. Is this what you consider evil? When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the effort of others. It is not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears, nor all the guns in the world can transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor. Your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you, there are men who will not default on that moral principle which is the root of money. Is this what you consider evil? Have you ever looked for the root of production? Take a look at an electric generator and dare tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left to you by men who had to discover it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that has ever existed on earth. But you say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak. What strength do you mean? It is not the strength of guns or muscles. Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. Then is money made by the man who invents a motor at the expense of those who did not invent it? Is money made by the intelligent at the expense of the fools, by the able at the expense of the incompetent, by the ambitious at the expense of the lazy? Money is made before it can be looted or mooched, made by the effort of every honest man, each to the extent of his ability. An honest man is one who knows that he can't consume more than he has produced. To trade by means of money is the code of the men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort except the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his effort in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not their loss. The recognition that they are not the beasts of burden born to carry the weight of your misery, that you must offer them values, not wounds, that the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy not the shoddiest they offer, but the best that your money can find. And when men live by trade, with reason, not force, as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance, the man of best judgment and highest ability. And the degree of a man's productiveness is the degree of his reward. This is the code of existence whose tool and symbol is money. Is this what you consider evil? But money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. It will give you the means for the satisfaction of your desires, but it will not provide you with desires. Money is the scourge of the men who attempt to reverse the law of causality, the men who seek to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind. Money will not produce happiness for the man who has no concept of what he wants. Money will not give him a code of values if he's evaded the knowledge of what to value. And it will not provide him with a purpose if he's evaded the choice of what to seek. Money will not buy intelligence for the fool, or admiration for the coward, or respect for the incompetent. The man who attempts to purchase the brains of his superiors to serve him with his money replacing his judgment ends up by becoming the victim of his inferiors. The men of intelligence desert him, but the cheats and the frauds come flocking to him, drawn by a law which he has not discovered, that no man may be smaller than his money. Is this the reason you call it evil? Only the man who does not need it is fit to inherit wealth. The man who would make his own fortune no matter where he started. If an heir is equal to his money, it serves him. If not, it destroys him. But you look on and you cry that money corrupted him. Did it? Or did he corrupt his money? Do not envy a worthless heir. His wealth is not yours, and you would have done no better with it. Do not think that it should have been distributed among you. Loading the world with 50 parasites instead of one would not bring back the dead virtue, which was the fortune. Money is a living power that dies without its root. Money will not serve the mind that cannot match it. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Money is your means of survival. The verdict you pronounce upon the source of your livelihood is the verdict you pronounce upon your life. If the source is corrupt, you have damned your own existence. Did you get your money by fraud, by pandering to men's vices or men's stupidity, by catering to fools in the hope of getting more than your ability deserves, by lowering your standards, by doing work you despise for purchasers you scorn? If so, then your money will not give you a moment's or a penny's worth of joy. Then all the things you buy will become not a tribute to you, but a reproach. Not an achievement, but a reminder of shame. Then you'll scream that money is evil. Evil because it would not pinch hit for your self-respect? Evil because it would not let you enjoy your depravity? Is this the root of your hatred of money? Money will always remain an effect and refuse to replace you as the cause. Money is the product of virtue, but it will not give you virtue and it will not redeem your vices. Money will not give you the unearned, neither in matter nor in spirit. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Or did you say that it's the love of money that's the root of all evil? To love a thing is to know and love its nature. To love money is to know and love the fact that money is the creation of the best power within you, and your passkey to trade your effort for the effort of the best among men. It's the person who would sell his soul for a nickel who is loudest in proclaiming his hatred of money, and he has good reason to hate it. The lovers of money are willing to work for it. They know they are able to deserve it. Let me give you a tip on a clue to men's characters. The man who damns money has obtained it dishonorably. The man who respects it has earned it. Run for your life from any man who tells you that money is evil. That sentence is the leper's bell of an approaching looter. So long as men live together on earth and need means to deal with one another, their only substitute, if they abandon money, is the muzzle of a gun. But money demands of you the highest virtues if you wish to make it or to keep it. Men who have no courage, pride, or self-esteem, men who have no moral sense of their right to their money and are not willing to defend it as they defend their life, men who apologize for being rich will not remain rich for long. They are the natural bait for the swarms of looters that stay under rocks for centuries but come crawling out at the first smell of a man who begs to be forgiven for the guilt of owning wealth. They will hasten to relieve him of the guilt and of his life, as he deserves. Then you will see the rise of the men of the double standard, the men who live by force, yet count on those who live by trade to create the value of their looted money, the men who are the hitchhikers of virtue. In a moral society, these are the criminals, and the statutes are written to protect you against them. But when a society establishes criminals by right and looters by law, men who use force to seize the wealth of disarmed victims, then money becomes its creator's avenger. Such looters believe it safe to rob defenseless men once they've passed a law to disarm them. But their loot becomes the magnet for other looters who get it from them as they got it. Then the race goes not to the ablest at production, but to those most ruthless at brutality. When force is the standard, the murderer wins over the pickpocket, and then that society vanishes in a spread of ruins and slaughter. Do you wish to know whether that day is coming? Watch money. Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see that trading is done not by consent, but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal, not in goods, but in favors, when you see that men get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them, but protect them against you, when you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming a self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Money is so noble a medium that it does not compete with guns and it does not make terms with brutality. It will not permit a country to survive as half property, half loot. Whenever destroyers appear among men, they start by destroying money. For money is men's protection and the base of a moral existence. Destroyers seize gold and leave to its owners a counterfeit pile of paper. This kills all objective standards and delivers men into the arbitrary power of an arbitrary setter of values. Gold was an objective value, an equivalent of wealth produced. Paper is a mortgage on wealth that does not exist, backed by a gun aimed at those who are expected to produce it. Paper is a check drawn by legal looters upon an account which is not theirs, upon the virtue of the victims. Watch for the day when it bounces marked, account overdrawn. When you have made evil the means of survival, do not expect men to remain good. Do not expect them to stay moral and lose their lives for the purpose of becoming the fodder of the immoral. Do not expect them to produce when production is punished and looting rewarded. Do not ask, who is destroying the world? You are. You stand in the midst of the greatest achievements of the greatest productive civilization, and you wonder why it's crumbling around you, while you're damning its lifeblood, money. You look upon money as the savages did before you, and you wonder why the jungle is creeping back to the edge of your cities. Throughout men's history, money was always seized by looters of one brand or another, whose names changed, but whose method remained the same: to seize wealth by force, and to keep the producers bound, demeaned, defamed, deprived of honor. That phrase about the evil of money, which you mouth with such righteous recklessness, comes from a time when wealth was produced by the labor of slaves. Slaves who repeated the motions once discovered by somebody's mind and left unimproved for centuries. So long as production was ruled by force and wealth was obtained by conquest, there was little to conquer. Yet through all the centuries of stagnation and starvation, men exalted the looters as aristocrats of the sword, as aristocrats of birth, as aristocrats of the bureau, and despised the producers as slaves, as traders, as shopkeepers, as industrialists. To the glory of mankind, there was, for the first and only time in history, a country of money. And I have no higher, more reverent tribute to pay to America for this means: a country of reason, justice, freedom, production, achievement. For the first time, man's mind and money were set free, and there were no fortunes by conquest, but only fortunes by work. And instead of swordsmen and slaves, there appeared the real maker of wealth, the greatest worker, the highest type of human being, the self-made man, the American industrialist. If you ask me to name the proudest distinction of Americans, I would choose, because it contains all the others, the fact that they were the people who created the phrase to make money. No other language or nation had ever used these words before. Men had always thought of wealth as a static quantity, to be seized, begged, inherited, shared, looted, or obtained as a favor. Americans were the first to understand that wealth was to be created. The words, to make money, hold the essence of human morality. Yet these were the words for which Americans were denounced by the rotted cultures of the looters' continents. Now the looters' credo has brought you to regard your proudest achievements as a hallmark of shame. Your prosperity is guilt. Your greatest men, the industrialists, as blackguards, and your magnificent factories as the product and property of muscular labor, the labor of whip-driven slaves like the pyramids of Egypt. The rotter who simpers that he sees no difference between the power of the dollar and the power of the whip ought to learn the difference on his own hide, as I think he will. Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be the tool by which men deal with one another, then men become the tools of men, blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice. There is no other, and your time is running out. Now, I know that was deep, that was long, but my goodness, I hope you got some additional insight out of that, and I'm anxious to hear the discussion, so I'm going to stop talking, stop reading, and open up the lines.
Good morning, my friends.
Good morning, Paul.
Hey, good morning, Melvin.
This is a chapter, and I suggest that everyone, just kind of relax and give themselves some time with a deeper understanding of the money issue, because it can be very complex. Money is a tool. And being that it's a tool, it could be used either way. It could be used to help. It could be used to hurt. In fact, you can think of money almost like water. And this water, you need it. You need it to live, and you need it to survive. And without it, you don't. And you drink it, and it serves you well. You can have too much of it, and you drown. So there's a lot to consider and understand about money. I know. Often when we talk about it, we talk about, you know, how much money do you want? It's not just so much how much money you want. It's how much freedom do you want? How much do you want to help other people? What kind of lifestyle do you want to live? Who else do you want to assist or care about? So, money. It's really a deep subject to get into. And I'm just saying here that we all should not try to nail it down or master it all right now, because it takes a lot of deep understanding to really comprehend money. But it is a great idea. It was an idea that allows you to transfer your work, your labor, your ideas from one place to another. It's not evil. It's what we make of it, and we can make of it something very beautiful. I don't want to say too much more about it, because it can just go on and on and on. We all each has to better get a grasp on it, and on an understanding of it on an individual basis. Back to you, Paul.
Melvin, really appreciate your comments and your wisdom. Thanks for being here. Star 6, who's next?
Hi, Paul. This is Frank from Delaware.
Hey, Frank. Good morning.
Good morning. Very interesting chapter, very thought-provoking, including the second reading that you did from Atlas Shrugged. I had written about this on my blog that I do, and it's really not the love of money, but it's what you do with the money. You can use it to ruin somebody else. You can use it to fund vices that you might have, like smoking or drugs. You can use it to fund your obsession with pornography. You can use it to fund terrorists. But it can also be used as a tool to do good things. It could be used to pay bills, for a family to pay bills. It could be used for a college fund for a kid. And the good things that it could be used for are just innumerable. I mean, everybody can think of some good that they're going to do with their money. Okay, so it does have a lot to do with the use that you choose to use this tool as, the use that you choose to have for this tool. So that's my thought about it, and back to you, Paul.
Frank, great thoughts and very good points. Star 6, who's next? Let's keep the discussion.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning.
Good. Hey, this is John Chapman, and I have got to tell you, that reading, I had, of course, heard of Ayn Rand's book, and you know, people either really hate it or people really love it. Just on the basis of that reading alone, I'm going to read that book because that was one of the most impassioned explanations of what money is. You want to talk about a lightning rod, especially in the political climate that we see ourselves in today. You know, whether you are pro Federal Reserve or against that entity. But one of the things that it really flashed to my mind was the whole poor dad, rich dad, poor dad type of situation. For myself, on a personal basis, I was raised by two fathers. One of them was my grandfather, and the other one was my stepfather, who married my mom. And both of these guys, they were incredible men, each in their own right, and they were very different men. I remember my stepfather, who had the heart of gold, and when he passed away, there was literally no standing room. There was no sitting room in the church. It was just packed. It was like literally packed from top all the way to bottom. And he built his wealth. Helping people. He did it in such a way that, you know, everyone loved him. And but I remember when I was a kid, he and I, we had a conversation about money, as parent and children often do. And he had said something to me because he was a carpenter. He was a handyman. He was a carpenter. He said that we had to be grateful for what the people gave us in regards to the job that you performed for them. God bless his soul, but he was horrible at charging a right use amount for the labor that he provided. And I remember that it did not sit well with me, even at a young age. That philosophy of you just have to be grateful for what you got, and that didn't sit well with me because I was more of the mindset of, you know, screw that. You get an honest wage for the amount that you put in. You demand what is due to you because of the value that you provide. And then that is in very much opposition to my birth father, who was a businessman. You know, he had multiple businesses, and it's just it was a very different understanding, a very different philosophy of money, where one dad, he had what I would characterize as almost a poor man's mentality. Even though when he passed away, he owned like five or six homes, but I, at the same time, and I know that he was happy, but at the same time, you know, there was the financial pressure, the financial issues that ultimately led to his death because of the stress. And my other dad, my birth father, who was very shrewd, who was a person that really demanded, you know, a fair use. You know, this is what I provide to you, and this is what you would provide to me. And it's very interesting to hear that impassioned explanation to what money actually is, because as we grow up, depending on who your parents are, you are raised with a mentality around money. Whether your parents believe, you know, that it's evil, you know, mistakenly adopting the mentality from scripture, or so they believe that you're supposed to be broke, as opposed to someone else who can read the same type of scriptures and say, no, you know, the Lord put us here to be wealthy. And I guess it really wasn't until I started to develop my own thoughts and beliefs, and especially get around people who thought the way that I wanted to think and who produced the results that I wanted to produce, did I really come and understand and fully appreciate that money, as I see it, is a barometer of the value that I give to the world. The more zeros that I see in my bank account, I know it's that much more value that I'm giving to the marketplace. And that is how I have come to see financial gain. As I gain more, it's because I know that I'm giving more. As I gain more, I know that I'm blessing others that much more fully. And even more so than that, because I have more, I can give more. And that's all for me today.
Mr. John Chapman, thank you so much for that really great insight, sharing your story and what you've gone through and your thought process. I got a lot of value from that. Thank you. Star 6, who's next?
Oh, Ms. from Albuquerque.
Hello. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. From this reading, what I got was the word try. And Barnes did not want to try. He wanted to do it. I want to read this from a book. One of the concepts of that subconscious mind does not understand is the word try. You cannot try to do anything. You cannot try to pick up a pencil. It just can't be done. You either do it or you don't do it. In fact, if you say to your friend, I'll try to be there, you might as well say that you are not going to be there. I could tell my children, tidy your room. If they tell me, I'll try to do it, I know that it will never happen. Since the subconscious does not understand the word try, it just assumes that whatever it is doesn't have to be done. So you are not going to try these techniques. You are going to experience them. Absolutely eliminate the word try. Instead, say, I'm going to use this technique. I'm going to do it. Approach this with a do attitude. That's all. Back to you, Paul.
Oh, wow. Beautiful, 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 beautiful. And thanks for bringing us back to the action steps. Folks, we were given clear action steps today from Dr. Napoleon Hill, and that was a great, 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 great illustration of how we need to do it. There is no try. In the words of Master Yoda, there is only do or do not. I love that. Thank you. Star 6, who's next? Come on out. I know you're feeling passionate about the discussion today. Share your thoughts with us.
Hello, Paul. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Aliasa out of Philadelphia.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Just like John said, I kind of stayed away from the Atlas Shrugged as well. Didn't want to go too into it. I heard a couple bad reviews. I saw they made a couple movies about it as well. But in light of that, I follow along with Think and Grow Rich with you guys. I just listened to the headphones. For whatever chapter we were on at the time. And not sure if you've read this book, but you know Wallace Wattles does have a book called The Science of Being Great as well. I've had it for a while. Something in my gut said pick it up, and this is what impacted me the most. It's not off topic. I just want to share it because it really left an indelible mark on me yesterday with what I'm dealing with, where I am in my business. And it says, no greater good can come to any man or woman than to become self-active. All the experiences of life are designed by Providence to force men and women into self-activity. to compel them to cease being creatures of circumstances and master their environment. In his lowest stage, man is the child of chance and circumstance and a slave of fear. His acts are all reactions resulting from the impingement upon him of forces in his environment. He acts only as he is acted upon. He originates nothing. But the lowest savage has within him a principle of power sufficient to master all that he fears. And if he learns this and becomes self-active, he becomes as one of the gods. So thanks. That's what I wanted to share, man, because that's exactly what I was dealing with in my business and in life. It was like I was reacting to everything and not being taking action with what's in front of me. So thanks a lot, Paul.
Oh, man, that was powerful. Thank you for sharing that. And I was actually not aware that he had written that book. I'm definitely going to have to get that. Thank you for that recommendation.
No problem.
Star 6, who's next?
Hey, guys, it's Doc Fran from beautiful Palm City, Florida.
Good morning, Doc.
You know, I love this. We've had a lot of delightful discussion over this, the attitude towards money. And every one of us on this phone has an attitude about money, we're conscious or not. And the reflection of what that attitude is how much money you have. And so if you don't have the money that you say you want, then where you need to really focus is on...
Hey, we're getting some feedback here. Doc, go ahead. I'm sorry about that.
That's not a problem.
Okay.
We need to focus on then is, you know, how do I really feel about money? Because you only have exactly the amount of money that you will allow yourself to have and that you are comfortable having. And if you don't have the amount of money that you want, don't obsess about what is my attitude, what is my limiting self-belief, because that is an action that is nothing but a form of procrastination. And it will not lead you to more money. What leads you to more money is taking action. And we're all in home-based businesses. And if we're not in home-based businesses, we're in a self-owned business. And folks, we all know that the only thing that creates more money is taking effective action to create more money. Well, what is the effective action in every one of our companies that is common to every company, and that is more sales. Enroll somebody. Every time you enroll someone, you create more money. Now, what is your attitude? You know, it may not seem like a lot that you get a dollar and a half or $10 or $50 or $300, whatever the amount is in your company, for that simple action of enrolling someone, but that is literally more money. We tend to think more money is some astronomical leap of money in a very short period of time, where we go from $100 to $10,000 or from $10,000 to $100,000. And that doesn't work. What works in most cases is the steady, repetitive, consistent, persistent, basic actions that consistently add money to your account. Back to you, Paul.
Great thoughts, Doc Fran. As always, appreciate hearing from you, my friend. Very wise. Star 6, who's next?
Hi, good morning. This is Dorenza. Can you hear me?
Yes, Dorenza. Good morning.
Good morning. Just reminded, great lesson, by the way. I'm just reminded of two thoughts. In the movie Wall Street, Gordon Gekko was saying that greed is good, that, you know, getting money and utilizing it and getting as much as you can is good. And then another thought is... I believe it was Zig Ziglar said that money's not everything, but it's right up there. It ranks right up there with oxygen. So we do need it. We do need it to function, to do the things that we need to do, to, you know, do trade and all that. But it goes back to people's perspective and the respect of money. If you respect money, then money will do good things for you and other people. But sometimes people have such a bad connotation of money that they let it flow through their fingers like sand and don't hold on to it and do what they need to do with it. So great lesson, and I just wanted to point those out as I was hearing the different speakers give their view of it. And you're right, money is the love of money, as the Bible says, is the root of all evil. But as you so profoundly shared with us, when we change our paradigm and change our mindset and open up our minds to really understanding the power that money can do and the good that money can do for us in our families and in our communities, then I think we have a better understanding and a better respect for it so that we can be able to do better for other people and ourselves. So thanks. Back to you.
Dorenza, beautiful thoughts and comments. Thank you so much for coming out and sharing that. Really appreciate that. Star
hey,
6, who's next? Yes.
It's Mahara, and I have a thought about money that I want to share with you.
Please.
I think that if you have no interest in generating money, then you are a selfish person who doesn't get the universe. Because if money is energy and influence and power to make decisions about the world and everything around you, if you leave it to chance, how things are going to go, then you're saying you don't care about the world. Just give me enough to make sure I have a hamburger on my plate and to heck with the world. I'm just worried about me, which is the problem with most people. That's why people don't look into politics or world situations or, you know, what could you do if you stepped up to the plate and put your heart and soul into making $1 million? What incredible thing could you do and accomplish? What mark could you leave on the world if you stepped into your power and took responsibility for making as much money and having as much influence for good on the world as you possibly can? It is not only admirable, but it's a responsibility. So if you think about it as, you know, staying broke is a selfish, self-indulgent thing to do, and I think the reason that people shy away from money is because we always use the word greed, and we don't really have a word to describe a healthy appetite for money. So what if the only word we had to describe food was gluttony? And nobody wants to be a glutton, but there are plenty of people who have an enjoyable, healthy relationship with food, and they love food. They even call them foodies. But that doesn't mean they're a glutton. They have a healthy interchange with the energy that food brings into our bodies. And I am suggesting that we all develop this healthy and yet altruistic relationship with money and realize that it is your vote. It is your chance to express yourself and leave a mark on the world. And unless you think you are a lower vibration than everyone else on the planet, in which case I would just appreciate you not to have any influence. If you think that you have good ideas and you want good for other people, if there's anything worthy and original inside you, then get off your butt and make a bunch of money and make something happen that's for someone else besides just yourself. Back to you, Paul.
I love you. That was beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Star 6, we have just a couple minutes left. Anyone else want to?
Good morning, my friends. Paul, Mr. Hutchins, how are you?
Excellent, excellent. Go ahead, sir.
My friend, you know, this is one of these conversations about money. If I have to have a conversation about money with somebody and what it can do for you and the people around you and who you love, I'm running from you. I'm running away. I don't need to be convincing anybody about what you can do. Just about in anything, there is good and evil. There is always a flip side to what you can do. This is one of these conversations. It's not even worth your time and energy trying to explain to anybody. It's a conversation. you don't get into with anybody. Don't waste your time. That's just that simple. You know, I'm sorry, excuse me. But you know what I want to really say this morning? Is my friend, you know, we've been thinking, I've read a lot of stuff about philosophers and the power of the thought. And I'm with it all. You know, not everybody can think correctly. But I tell you what, everybody got these hunches. Do you have a feeling? You better start respecting those feelings. I'm telling you, opportunity have a way of disguising itself and cloaking itself in all different kind of forms. And how many times things come around you and you mistrust them? And you think that nothing ever comes my way. Nothing ever comes my way. I mean, I'm telling you, it comes to people. I cannot tell you how many times. Because either fear or whatever it is, I wasn't prepared that I let opportunity slip me by. I cannot tell you how many times. It's incredible. The thing called feelings, the little thing you have, these little hunches, respect them. My friend, look around you. I would ask you, everyone, to cooperate for a second and make 180-degree turn from where you are. And at any point in time from this moment on, make another 180-degree in any direction. I think you will agree by now that you end up in the same place where you were. What do? You spun around in circle. Why? Because you're not moving forward. Forward thinking is the key. Moving forward, doing something different. If something doesn't work one way, you try it another way. The word try, I don't know why so many people try to run away from this word try. Because if it, first of all, you try and you don't succeed, you keep on trying till you get it. Trying is very powerful. If I ask somebody who's never lifted up 300 pounds in their life, I'm asking them to go do it. Doing becomes a habit. After you try to do something, you develop the repetition of trying something and doing it over, you become a doer. You come doing it because if I ask you to pick up 300 pounds and you've never done it, you have to go try. You didn't get it, you keep trying it till you pick it up. Then I go ask you again, now go do it because you can do it. You've done it over and over till it become a habit. Becomes a part because you have to try. You have to try to do something. Don't be twisting things all over the place. You know, a lot of things have been working for many people. And we come and try to reinvent the wheel. Many people through the years and ages have done things. We spend a lot of time trying to recreate the wheel.
Hey, Rick, sorry to interrupt you, buddy, but we're over time, man. Sorry, you're getting close. Sorry, man, I'm so sorry. I just want to respect everyone's time here.
I have a prosperous day, I have a money-making day, I have a profitable day, I have a healthy day. Thank you very much. It's wonderful. I'm excited. Thank you.
Rick, you're a beautiful man. I appreciate that. And sorry to keep you to the very last call. I know you've got a lot to share here, but we are a little bit over. So I want to close out the call. Folks, thanks for being here today. I do hope that you've gleaned some insight from the call today, and I just want to share a couple final, real quick closing thoughts. Napoleon Hill, in his book, The Law of Success, talks about tolerance as being one of the principles of having success in life. And I want to challenge everybody to have tolerance. And what does tolerance mean? Tolerance means that if I'm a Christian, I'm still going to read a book on Buddha, and I'm going to seek to understand. If I'm a Democrat, I'm still going to listen to ideas of the Republicans so that I can think and process where they're coming from. If I'm a Republican, I'm still going to listen to ideas of the Democrats to think and process for myself. If I hear that there are negative reviews on Atlas Shrugged, I'm going to go get the dang book, and I'm going to read it myself so I can think and process Why the negative reviews? Where is this philosophy? Where is it coming from? Is there merit? Is there not merit? Folks, let us have tolerance. Let us not fear to investigate ideas. Let us start to understand money. Folks, let us understand money. How do you understand money? You got to think about it. You got to think about where it comes from. You got to think about what it represents. In my pondering of money over the last few days, I've come to the conclusion that money is a representation of the physical and mental labors of men and women. That's all it is. It's a representation of the physical labors of men and women. And I love that. I love the fact that myself as a person can take the best of what I have to offer, translate that into dollars, and then take those dollars and trade the best of what I have for the best of what someone else has, and we can engage in that exchange. I love that. I love the fact that I can be the best that I can be, and I can engage in commerce with others who are endeavoring to be the best that they can be. I love that fact. And I love the fact that, you know, we can generate more income and use it to do good. We can generate more income, and yeah, I don't love the fact that we can use it to do more bad, but we certainly can. But we have to come to terms with what money is, what it represents, and we have to understand, like Doc Frank said, the amount of money we have right now is a direct reflection of our attitude on money. So also let us take the action steps today. I'm going to take the action steps today. Napoleon Hill, Dr. Napoleon Hill told us to be definite as to the amount. Follow those steps, folks. Get out there. Have a great day. We'll see you back here tomorrow morning on Thinking Grace Call. Love you. Believe in you. Take care. Goodbye.